He's 5 foot two and he's 6 feet four. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you.
Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is one of two parts of our series on Vietnam veterans, and it's called Addendum. And the third person that we have interviewed in this series is Lieutenant Colonel Don Ice. He is 93 now. Don was deployed to Vietnam in 1966. He was 35. He left in a quiet suburb in a blizzard and arrived at a war zone in tropical heat within a very short period of time. And it's our honor to be able to interview Don. He is living now in Olympia, and we are in his home recording. So, hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and we are here in the beautiful home of Don Ice, Colonel, Lieutenant Colonel Don Ice, and I'm interviewing him today for our Vietnam series. Don was in the service in the military for 20 years, correct, yeah. Don?
Right, that's right.
And he commanded, how many men were in that you commanded and when you were in Vietnam?
Oh, I suppose there was about 180.
About 180 men.
Yeah.
And this whole series, this is very important, this whole series on Vietnam is not to deal with political issues, but to deal with the men that served, the veterans that we owe our respect to for serving in not just the war in Vietnam, but other wars and conflicts around the world. Don, I'd like to talk a little bit about you growing up and kind of your life as a young person. Where were you born, Don?
Fort Lewis.
You were born at Fort Lewis.
Yes.
So it's kind of like being in the military all your life, huh? So you were born in Fort Lewis. You didn't have a uniform when you were born, I don't suppose.
No,
not then.
No.
But so, and where did you go to high school?
DuPont. Right across
DuPont.
The,
so
right
across from where we are right now. We're down in Olympia.
Yeah.
And
Highway 99 was only a two-lane road.
Yep, Highway 99 was only a two-way lane road. And DuPont has just blossomed. I mean, it used to be just the one insurance company there when you went down I-5, and now it's a giant place. And so you went to high school in DuPont, and you graduated when?
Well, I got out of, it was a junior high school, and I graduated there in the ninth grade.
Okay.
And I went to high school down in Lewis County after my father retired from the Army.
Okay, and so Don came from a military family. His father was, I think you said he was a
Sergeant Major.
He was a Sergeant Major, and he was... He works with the military police?
He ran the military police.
For Fort Lewis, right.
Yeah.
And that's another story. We can even talk about Fort Lewis back then. When did you join the military? You volunteered, correct?
I volunteered in 1950, but And I'd been in 2 weeks when the Korean War started.
So Don's timing wasn't exactly the greatest, but he
I remember my platoon sergeant coming out and saying, they started a war in Korea. He says, but don't worry about it. It'll be over in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. We have a way of saying, I think sometimes we have a way of saying, don't we, that these wars are going to be right over.
Well, where they missed it, I had joined the Air Force initially, and everybody thought that Truman was going to drop the atomic bomb and end it right away. At least the Air Force did. But no, we were a long way.
Right.
All the bombers, right. All our bombers were in the down in Arizona in the, what they call the boneyard.
Yeah, it was dry down there, and it kept the planes could
kept
stay
the planes
without
down
getting
there. And so my first job was getting all those airplanes out of the boneyard and getting the recalling pilots from all over the place who had forgotten how to fly them.
And so you spent time during the Korean War then too.
Yeah, I was in the Korean War. Yeah.
Were you in Korea?
Yeah.
And how long were you there?
6 months. The last 6 months of the war, I volunteered to go to Army OCS, and they graduated from OCS. And they sent me straight to Korea.
Okay. So then you got out of the Korean War, and then where did you serve?
Well, I came back to the United States, and I was an air defense artillery officer at that point. And
air defense artillery officer.
And first I got into the Boston Air Defense. I didn't like it there. They were keep threatening to send me up to Thule, Greenland.
Yeah.
So yeah, I put in for flight school, went to flight school in the Army there.
Okay.
That was down in Georgia.
Uh-huh. And one of the things of when I and he, just to let everybody know, here with us is also Rick Ames is our engineer, and also with us is Steve Ice, who is Don's son and a friend of mine, who lives also on Vashon Island. And one of the things that Steve told me, he said, when you went to Vietnam, you left this area in a blizzard. Is that correct?
It was a snowstorm, yeah.
A snowstorm, yeah.
So walked out to Highway 1 there in Virginia and took the bus to the Dulles Airport. Yeah.
Dulles Airport, yeah. That,
yeah.
Yeah. Now there's two airports there: the Ronald Reagan Airport.
I should tell you about a little bit about Korea, though. I was there the last 6 months of the war.
Okay.
And I was a forward observer at first on the ground adjusting artillery fire. And then I went back to become an air observer, flying in a plane and adjusting artillery.
You were kind of flying above and telling them where to drop the ordnance, right?
Yeah, they usually set me off with an assigned target for destruction. I was dealing with really heavy artillery, the biggest thing they had, and they would give me a target to destroy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an interesting thing happen to me.
Tell me.
As the war was coming to a close, I was flying 4-hour missions, and the war was coming to the close. There was a Navy admiral, I think, was trying to negotiate a ceasefire and a prisoner exchange with North Korea and China. And what happened was Syngman Rhee was the president of Korea.
Correct.
And he did not want the war to end with a divided country. And unfortunately for us, he was holding all of our prisoners, him and the South Korean army, and he turned the prisoners loose. And the prisoners were always making their way back through our lines and trying to get back into North Korea. And so I drew my mission one day, and it was to look at the coordinates. I said, I can't do that. That's one of our own artillery batteries. And they said, well, you've got to. He said, the North Koreans have it, and it's been overrun, so you got to blow it up. And I knew there was a lot of Americans in there. It was an 8-inch battery from the Indiana National Guard. And so I didn't really have to do a lot of adjusting. They had that battery surveyed in. They knew exactly where it was. And the first rounds hit the battery center. And I think I added 50 yards to get into the ammunition, and that went all off. Then the war went on a little while after that. It ended up sometime in June or July.
Yeah, I think it was in July, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember the end of the night that it ended. It was 10:30 at night, and we were firing everything we had, and everybody said, get rid of all the ammunition, you know. We're going to have to haul it home. So it went right up to 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock, they cut it off, and you couldn't even hear a rifle shot. It ended.
So from total noise and...
From total destruction to nothing.
To total silence.
That's right.
Wow. What a difference. Yeah. And when did you first get in? When did you first go to Vietnam? You said 1966?
66. That's right.
66. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was really at the time that things were really building. I graduated from high school in 66, and over half the men in my graduating class went from graduating in Ellensburg in June to Fort Lewis to Vietnam, in some of them as soon as October. And most of those young men were going to go to work in the farms with their parents, with their family farms, and they had no deferments. So they knew that that things were up for them, and they had to go to Vietnam. I've always asked this question to everyone. When you first got off the plane in Vietnam, where did you land?
Well, what's the capital of Vietnam?
Saigon?
Saigon, right in Saigon. We flew to, I think we refueled in Hawaii, and we refueled in the Philippines. But we wouldn't let it. They wouldn't let us off the airplane because we weren't on a Philippine airline. That the head of the Philippines didn't want anybody to get off airplanes there unless they came in on his airline.
Yeah. So, what was your first impression when you landed in Vietnam? What was your first impression of the country?
Well, I was wondering where they're going to assign me. I went to the replacement center, and they asked them where they're going to put me, and they said, well, they didn't know yet, but I remember telling them that I'd like to go up to the first cab because I used to be in the first cab when I was a lieutenant.
Oh, when you're a lieutenant, you're in the first cavalry?
Yeah, up in Japan. And they said, okay, we'll see what we can do. But the next day when they called me back, they said, you can't go up there. And I said, well, why not? He says, well, you've got too much rank.
Ah.
I was a pretty senior lieutenant colonel already, and they, I mean, a major, major. I was a major then. I was a pretty senior major.
So you were overqualified.
They said, we've already picked out the commanders for up there.
Oh, you were overqualified.
And if you if we send you up there, you'd have to replace one of the commanders that they've already picked out.
Mm-hmm. So where did when you eventually had your command, where did you, where were you based?
A place called Fuloy, which is north of Saigon.
Okay.
And we had...
And that was an air base?
It was for helicopters.
There
was no airstrip there.
Right.
The closest airstrip was over at...
Must have been a pretty big... You'd have to have a pretty big airstrip to land some of the large planes that were used for bombing, certainly.
Yeah, these... At Fuloy, it had a lot of gravel, but no runways.
So. Right. I talked to some of the
helicopters.
Pilots. Yeah, I talked to some of the pilots who said that some of the airstrips where they were going in and out were, you know, when you took off right above the jungle. I mean, pretty short to land. So you had. About how many helicopters were you in charge of?
About almost 30.
Yeah. Almost 30 helicopters.
Yeah.
And so tell me what would be with your group, were they used for supplying the troops? Were they used for medevac?
Everything.
Everything, okay.
If you... We started doing air assaults.
So you would take in a lot of helicopters at one time to assault an area?
Usually about four companies would join up on an assault.
And a company is about how many?
Well, it's 10 helicopters at least four gunships every time you go.
So the gunships are also helicopters, correct?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But they're armed.
But they're armed.
Yeah. They got rockets and machine guns.
Okay. So do they go in first? Is that the idea? They go in first? Or?
Oh, I'll tell you how it works. It's first thing there is a preparation. And the preparation is generally done on one side of the landing zone that where you're going. The place you're assaulting. One side is going to be prepared by TAC Air, Air Force, or Navy, and the other side is field artillery. They hit it with field artillery pretty hard for 10, 15 minutes. And then as you approach it, I know this really well because I fly on a lead helicopter a lot of times.
Yeah.
As you start going in, they shift the fire back. The artillery shifts back 50 yards this way and attack here 50 yards this way to let you in. But that doesn't happen until you're on short final.
Uh-huh.
So then, when you're on short final and they shift that fire back, the door gunners start opening up. You got machine gun fire going out of the helicopters. And the infantry can shoot too if they want to. They shoot out the doors. But the idea is to keep everybody's head down until you get established on the ground. And sometimes the enemy's waiting for you, and sometimes they're not.
So basically, what you're saying is, you provided a lot of fire on the ground so that the enemy was basically hidden in the trees or laying very low
they're trying to keep the enemy from shooting you down.
So you could drop the helicopters troops could get out of the helicopters.
That's right, and they got to make it to the tree lines on the sides, you know, before. They make it to cover themselves, get out of the clearing that you're landing in.
And sometimes
you'd end up with a lot of wounded, and sometimes you wouldn't. So.
And then if you got a lot of wounded on the ground, then you had to medevac them, correct?
Yeah, they would do the triage. Where these guys are going to make it. These guys can get back into action. These guys need to get to the hospital.
Quickly. Need to get to the hospital quickly, yeah. And Steve told me a time when you were a major and you led a helicopter company in, and one of your commanding or someone under you or someone above you, their helicopter was shot down. Is it?
Well, I had a battalion commander, and he did get shot down. Yeah. Well, I think here's one of the things that bothered me about Vietnam is that the Army was sending. I've been flying for 15 years, practically. And, well, not 15, but at least 12. 15 by the time I retired.
Close enough, yeah.
But the Army made me make a mistake, in my opinion. They were sending senior officers to flight school and sending them right into combat without hardly any flying time. And so this battalion commander that I was under, he was right out of flight school, and that was bad news. And he got overloaded, and he overloaded and tried to take off, and he wasn't shot down. He just ran out of power and pitch and everything else, and ended up...
So he was carrying too much material, or...?
Well, he was carrying too much, but it... You're fighting the humidity, too, and the density altitude is getting higher. So
as you get higher in the altitude, it's tougher to lift off, is that?
In the middle of summer when it's hot, you know, you just don't have the power. And he got overloaded and went in upside down into a Vietnamese graveyard.
And were there troops, other troops on the... On that helicopter?
He was totally loaded, yeah. I can't tell you how many were on, but I know his co-pilot died. And he survived it. But that's another one of my points about the Army aviation. They want to send senior people. They send senior people right to flight school and send them over there and make battalion commanders out of them. And they didn't have the
flight experience. It must have been really unusual to fly in Vietnam too. I mean, how do you train someone to fly in a situation like that? Does that make sense?
Well, it's different than flying in the States a lot because you have the monsoons that come in,
right.
and that's heavy weather, and a lot of time you're trying to fight your way through that stuff, and the density altitude, it's hot down there, so you don't have the lift that you got the way where it's cooler.
Right. Right.
Yeah, and so it's a learning experience.
I know that there was, as an example, kind of for the audience here, if and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but as the altitude gets higher and the temperature gets higher, it's tougher to take off. And there was a very large 747. This was actually in Spokane.
In the winter, you have the monsoons,
yeah.
And in the summertime, it's hot out, and you haven't got the lift.
And what I was saying is that the 747 was carrying a very, very large load, and they had to wait until the very specific time in the morning when it was cooler to lift that load off. So you just eat basically this this person just basically tried to lift off, didn't have the power, didn't have the turning ability. The helicopter flipped and crashed.
Yeah, it was taken off from one place that I was, the warrant officer was flying it, and I was taken off this one place. And when you start losing rotor RPM and decaying, and then you hear this warning thing come on, you know, whoop, 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 whoop. And when I heard that,
You could hear it from your ear.
I got it, and I took the control and hit punch full right pedal, and I went back, and I crashed. Well, I didn't crash. I didn't break anything, but I hit hard. But I got it back on the ground before we ran out of rotor RPM.
Yeah. what were you on the ground? Were you infantry on the ground at all to yourself?
No.
Okay. Steve told me about a time when you were apparently on the ground someplace and you saw a young 15-year-old boy that walked right by you. And
I know what he was talking about. I was told to recon a place for my helicopter company would be for the night.
So you were trying to find a place for everybody to land.
I flew in there to
that would be safe.
Walk over the ground and make sure that I could use it and that I could get everybody in there. And I was by myself practically. And
were other people with you on the? Several other folks with you looking at this?
We were in, you couldn't have called it enemy territory or friendly territory. I didn't know which one it was, but we'd had fights in that area. And I was just looking it over. And I saw a fella coming up the, up the trail. And he had a rifle. And I was just thinking that...
And he was a young person.
Young boy, yeah. And I really didn't want to get in a firefight with him. So he stood real still, and he came up, he walked up to me about as far as across this room, but it was brushy. And I don't think he ever saw me, but I was worried because I was... For one thing, he had a little dog with him, and that didn't look to me like an enemy soldier.
Yeah.
And anybody's carrying this rifle, and I said, what am I going to do if he points that thing at me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I just stood real still, and finally, he came up to me and looked all around, never saw me, he didn't indicate that he had seen me, turned around and walked back the other way, and I said...
Yeah, it's hard to tell if he's got a rifle, you know, whether he's
it's hard to figure who's enemy and who's friendly. And,
yeah. Did you when you were there and did you served how many, just one tour or how many tours of duty did you serve in Vietnam?
Just one.
So you and at the time you were there, you were 35 or. Kind of in that age range?
Yeah.
Okay. So really at 35, if you think about, Vietnam, the average age of the person in Vietnam, the average age of infantry and troops was just a little over 21.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of infantry there that were just drafted.
In 18 to 21.
Yeah.
Again, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this has been our pleasure to interview Lieutenant Colonel Don Ice. One of the things that was so poignant when I talked to Don in our closing here was a poem by Robert Frost titled Out, Out. And he specifically remembered the line, "And they... since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs." Thank you very much for listening.
He's 5 foot two and he's 6 feet four. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years.